This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. Now, it's 7.05 in the morning, Monday the 22nd of March, and today is, of course, also World Water Day. So in conjunction with the fact with that, BFM on The Morning Run today specifically, we're going to be taking a look at how waterways provide access and have geopolitical implications on the region later on at about 7.30am, so be sure to stay tuned for that. But before that, in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking about the Social Work Profession Bill with Dr. Suhaimi Mohammed of the Malaysian Association of Social Workers. But now we're taking a look at what's been happening over in the markets.
Well, if we take a look at the Asian markets at the close on Friday, it was predominantly a red day, actually. No, not predominantly. It was entirely a red day. I take that back. The Hong Kong Hang Seng was down 1.4%. Shanghai Composite was down 1.7%. Nikkei 225 down 1.4% as well. The Korea's Kospi was down 0.9%. Australia's ASX 200 down 0.1%. I think and this is in line as well with how Singapore and Malaysia did. The Singapore STI was down 0.1% and so was the FBM KLCI. If we take a look at the year-to-date number, the KLCI is down marginally 0.01% in the red year-to-date, with the Shanghai Composite, the only other market that we take a look at that is also in the red year-to-date, down 2% on that front.
And in US markets as well, the Dow Jones was down 0.7%. The S&P 500 was down pretty marginally, but 0.1% in the red. And the NASDAQ, though, was down 0.8%.
I say it was up 0.8%.
NASDAQ was up 0.8%. So this morning we are taking a look at international markets with insight from Stephen Innes, Chief Global Market Strategist over at Axie. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today. Now, markets do seem to be fixated on the dollar's correlation to US yields. Why are commodity stock flows and relative rates more important in determining the US dollar's direction?
Well, it's generally that way. Like, everybody seems to be talking about, well, US yields are up, that means the dollar is stronger. But if you look at other currencies during that cycle, for instance, like the Canadian dollar, well, why was that getting stronger? Well, it was getting stronger not only because of oil prices, but it was getting stronger because their interest rates were also rising. Similarly, we can look at the Australian dollar, whose rates have also been going up too. So I think you have to look at things on a broader picture, just not isolating U.S. interest rates up, that means the U.S. dollar goes higher across the board. There's other factors that you have to look at. Asia's a bit of a different basket, however. Higher yields tend to be quite negative in the Asia FX landscape, regardless of yields. And this is simply because it has this wrecking ball effect. In other words, stronger U.S. dollar through Asia really hurts a lot of repayment of U.S. debt. Remember, a lot of Asian currencies run U.S. dollar debt. So, you know, a stronger U.S. dollar makes it more expensive to pay that debt. So, first of all, that's the channel that people start selling local Asia currencies. And that's a bit of a difference. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge of events and views going on in currency markets right now.
Is this enough to compel emerging markets to raise interest rates?
They can, but obviously there's a double-edged sword about raising interest rates, because you don't really want to raise interest rates in a economic when you're trying to recover from a real economic beatdown. That could also be perceived negative. So there's not a lot you can really do when the U.S. dollar starts acting like that wrecking ball. Put up rates could offer temporary reprieve. Then the market says, why are you putting up rates when you should be lowering rates to get the economy improved? So it's just a constant evolving cycle of events that happen in the foreign exchange markets that are sometimes just totally unexplainable.
Meanwhile, while we're talking about emerging markets and currencies, Stephen, the Turkish lira plunged as much as 17% after President Erdogan dismissed the central bank chief. Will this have a contagion effect on emerging market currencies?
Not really. I think, you know, this is like the third pink slip President Erdogan's handed out in the last 2 years. And obviously, the shock here is more to do with central bank autonomy than anything else. I don't think central bank autonomy is in threat anywhere throughout the world other than, you know, perhaps Turkey. So I would look at this more as an idiosyncratic and an isolated situation rather than anything else.
So I think the new central bank governor is one who is for lowering interest rates. And how might this affect other emerging markets, or, you know, are there any markets that may be affected?
Well, you know, honestly, the next move for most central bankers is up. But obviously, in the eyes of the Turkish president, that's not necessarily the case. Or perhaps he didn't mind it going 100 basis points, but certainly not beating market expectations of 200 basis points. So the big fear here outside of Turkey is inflation. And the problem that central banks are going to find is that they've got themselves sort of boxed into a corner right now. They're taking the view here that inflation is going to be transitory. It could be right. I don't really know. I don't think anybody has any idea what inflation is going to do in the future, because we've never really recovered from this type of a beatdown before. And we've never really had this much stimulus. So we don't know how consumers are going to react, how supply chains, which are a big part of the issue, because people can't get those goods to buy, which is a problem, how it's going to react. Is it going to be 6 months of transitory inflation, or is it going to be an enduring inflation where the feds are going to have to move interest rates? This is where the wall of worry is happening, where the debate is starting to happen. Bond markets are saying, listen, we don't believe you, Fed. We think inflation is coming, and that's why we're selling bonds. And this is why short date interest rate traders are pushing up interest rates, because they want to cover those what they refer to as tail risks, which are the risks to the right hand side. In other words, they want to hedge that they don't fall behind the curve on the futures market.
And now if we take a look at the ringgit as well this morning, Stephen, the ringgit's value has fallen against the US dollar in the past month. Are there any specific catalysts driving our currency lower?
Yeah, again, it's just the US dollar wrecking ball effect. First of all, the higher yields, and there's a lot of Malaysian debt that's denominated in US dollars. It's just the reason why people denominate debt in US dollars is simply because there's a big pool of investors that buy US dollar denominated debt. However, when the dollar gets stronger, it makes those coupon payments that much more expensive. That's the first thing. Second of all, we've seen a slide in oil prices, and that's really another sort of providing a double negative. But we also have to look at what's going on in China here. Now, the U.S.-China trade talks didn't get off to a very good start. Immediately, the yuan weakened. Now, it didn't really get battered to any degree, and it's not because people think that there's going to be a re-escalation of trade war. It's just that those dialogues between the two superpowers aren't looking as good. And we have to remember, people were buying the yuan on one premise, that perhaps Biden would be a little bit more softer when it came to U.S.-China relationships. That's not happening so far. So, you know, if we look at the yuan as a bellwether for the region, well, that's another reason why the ringgit's weakening off also, in tangent with the yuan weakening off a touch.
Right. And you know, when we talk about the ringgit, Stephen, we often also, as you did, relate it back to oil. And as you mentioned, it seems that oil's recent bullish run seems to have lost some momentum of late. What's triggering the sell-off and the price correction?
Well, I don't agree with what's getting printed in the papers these days. I think to a small degree there was the AstraZeneca news certainly started the momentum, but really we've been able to dance through vaccine and do sell-offs in the past, and there's multiple vaccines in the pipeline. And you know, Europe's like 15% of global demand, so that's not a huge hit whatsoever. But if you look at a technical picture here, we had the expiry date coming up for the WTI contract. And we've noticed from that Texas freeze, we had a huge buildup in inventories. Now, those inventories depleted, but there were some concerns about settlement risk. And this really weighed on a lot of investors. So we saw investors cut a lot of futures along the curve, and this impacted the spot market. Now, you know, there's been numerous adjustments to the USO fund methodology last year to reduce market impacts going into settlements. But while it's calmed a little bit, I think it's going to take a little bit more confidence for those type of investors that are really hedging for the reflation trade, that are buying futures along the curve, to come back to the market. So as opposed to a, you know, market-driven event, i.e. through, you know, the AstraZeneca sell-off, I think there's more to it. I think it's more of a technical adjustment. I think oil remains bid, but I think we have to get through this technical adjustment period to see how the markets come back convincingly again.
Stephen, you know, some of the contracts are coming to an expiry at the WTI. And last year, we did see that negative prices for a little bit on the back of some amount of, people being unable to take deliveries and all of that. How much you read that kind of risk happening this year? Have we learned from the past? And do you think that will happen again?
No, I don't think we'll see that again. I think once was enough of a shock. I think the markets are a bit more, understand. But you have to remember, we're talking about minuscule adjustments relative to major adjustments here. We're looking at about, you know, a $3 to $5 rollover impact, right? That the markets didn't consider. And analysts and traders are a lot different. Traders consider these bottom line costs. Analysts just will repeat whatever the headlines are saying. But if you're actually trading, you have to take your rollover costs into perspective. And when those curves in the back end start to weigh down, something has to give, right? So generally speaking, the front end gives to match the back end. And that's what we're seeing happening. Simply a technical, but you have to remember, this is an artificially driven market here. The only reason why we're up at these prices is because OPEC is holding 8 million barrels per day back. So there's something to be said about the current structure in the market overall. It's not as bullish as what people think.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Stephen. That was Stephen Innes, Chief Global Market Strategist at Axie, giving us a bit of insight into international markets. And of course, also taking a look, we spoke with him about the Turkish lira, because in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he's made a shock move to replace the country's central bank chief. So, of course, throwing that central bank independence into question, the lira plunged as much as 17% on the back of that.
Yes, I think that move came, on Thursday, the Turkish former central bank governor, he raised interest rate, I think, by 200 basis points, and that took the interest rate to 19%, higher than what analysts had forecasted. So that's quite drastic. But if you consider what's happening in Turkey, inflation is close to 16%, unemployment rate is 12%. There's just so many issues to be dealt with in Turkey.
And we also talked about oil. And on that note, let's jump over to Saudi Aramco, which is sticking by its $75 billion dividend despite a sharp fall in profit. The payout is the largest of any listed company, and almost all of it will go to the Saudi Arabian government. Net income for 2020 stood at about $49 billion. That's 44% down from 2019, but slightly better than analysts' expectations. And I think this is something that Malaysians can relate to, because we also saw, I think, Petronas take its first reported loss in a certain number of years, or ever, right? Because end of the day, we saw demand fall, and correspondingly to that, the oil markets last year was generally quite low. We're seeing oil prices recover now, so hopefully we'll see some of it change going forward in terms of how the dividends are paid out by these primarily state-owned oil companies like Saudi Aramco.
Aramco certainly has taken on more debt, I think, in the past 12 months to keep up this dividend in the face of their dwindling cash flow. Although it's worth noting that their gearing still remains below that of firms like Royal Dutch Shell. Now, Aramco has said that the dividend won't rise above $75 billion this year, and they're pretty optimistic about 2021. But now we're about to head into some messages, and then up next, we're going to be taking a look at the Social Work Profession Bill with Dr. Suhaimi Mohammed of the Malaysian Association of Social Workers. So stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.